Good morning. So last time we started talking about describing hardware and our hardware description languages. We mentioned this idea of carrying values in our processor using what we called wires, which are often really bundles of wires that hold some number of bits and move them from one place to another. We saw our syntax for declaring and assigning wires. We mentioned that wire assignment is something where the wire is connected or it's not. So order didn't matter. You know, when we were simulating our circuits that we wrote in HCLRS, the simulator said, okay, I'm looking for the value of wire bundle X, and I see what that's connected to. I don't care where it's connected in your description file. We talked about registers. So you mentioned that, well, if you want to do things like counting, we can't just build the naive circuit that like adds one and the output goes to adding one again, because that's not going to be stable. That all our sort of logic circuits that we use by default are going to compute things as their inputs change. And ordinarily, that's great. That means they're computing things as fast as possible. But that's not so great if you're trying to feed them back to themselves, because they'll have these in-between values that they'll be trying to process, and they'll never have time to like stabilize on a single value. So we need some sort of component that can control when we go from one step of a calculation to the next, and make sure we hold our inputs stable long enough for our calculating circuits to actually get a stable value. And the main component we're going to use for that is registers. So these registers store a value, and they have this global clock signal that determines when they read in new values. And we show that this clock signal sort of has this oscillating part where we have these distinct, what we called rising edges, which is where they're going to read values, and they always output their current value. So once we had a way of sort of going from step to step, we also need a way of making decisions. And well, we can do this with sort of our bit manipulation stuff, but we have sort of a higher level tool. So we saw sort of from a actually building circuits kind of tool, we had this idea of something kind of like a logic gate, which takes in a bunch of inputs and a selector input, and the selector input chooses which of those bunch of inputs it outputs. And we have this abstraction that represents that circuit, which was a case expression, where our assumption is that the hardware description language would handle taking a bunch of conditions and turning them into a selector signal for us, because that's actually a fairly easy process to automate. And so we end up representing these muxes, or multiplexers is the full name, using those case expressions. So questions on things we covered last time? Okay, questions on things from the quiz? Okay, so I have some slides on the quiz, but there's not questions on those. Well, I guess I should go through them quickly, because the preliminary look says probably I should mention something, at least for the recording. Question 4 and 5. So question 4 was asking where i10 bytes came from. And the thing to remember is we had i10 bytes was part of our instruction memory. So we had our PC, which is the name of the signal that goes into this instruction memory, which outputs i10 bytes, which is where we read our instructions from. And so far, it's where we've determined what the opcode is. But we mentioned that it actually reads 10 bytes. Why 10 bytes? That's our biggest instruction. And since it's reading multiple bytes, and each byte has its own memory address, it's going to read more than just one byte to get its i10 bytes output. It turned out in this our example that the PC input before any rising edge of the clock was 1. So it would read from 1 to 10 inclusive, 10 being OXA and hex. And for question 5, we did something very similar in lecture. This was basically saying we had a bunch of registers connected to each other with some logic circuits. You wanted to simulate to figure out what Y bar would be outputting after two rising edges of the clock. initially, the outputs of the registers foo and bar were 0 and 5 because that was their initial values. We then evaluated what x foo and x bar were and found out we had 1 and 6. So during the next cycle, they were 1 and 6. Repeated that process, and every time I was just using these expressions to evaluate what would happen during each clock cycle between each of the pairs of rising edges, or beginning and rising edge and end. So questions about anything from the quiz? You're all happy. Okay. So we're gonna get back to building simple processors. So earlier we built a processor that did nop and halt and jump. And so far we haven't actually dealt with instructions that like put values anywhere useful, right? We've just been manipulating the program counter, which is very important, but probably we want our programs to like set registers in memory. So we're gonna start by setting registers. And we're gonna talk about implementing the add instruction. And so for the add instruction, we have these two indices of registers, which have to be stored somewhere, and the question is, where are we storing these? And one thing we could do is we could say, well, we know how to build registers like the PC. We could build storage in that same way for RAX, RBX, RCX, and so on. But to keep things simpler, we're going to say that someone else has done that work for you, that someone else has built what we'll call a register file, which contains our general purpose registers, RAX, RCX, all the way up to R14. And the register file is a built-in component like the instruction memory, so you don't have to make it. And you have to use our register file, or else it's going to be hard for us to tell if your simulated processor works correctly. Like, otherwise, we could let you do your own thing, but we have to be able to figure out what values are in registers. So here's sort of a diagram of the inputs and outputs of the built-in register file. So the main thing that this has is we have two inputs where we specify the index of a register to read, and we get the value of the register. So this works very similarly to the instruction memory. Instead of specifying a memory address, we specify a register index. Register index is like one of those numbers that we put in the instruction to represent RAX, RCX, R8, whatever register we want. And we get out a 64-bit value, which is its output. And like the instruction memory, this happens before rising edge of the clock. Just, you know, as the inputs change, the register file will start outputting the value of the correct register. We also need to be able to write registers. And the way this is going to work is we're going to have separate inputs where we can specify the index of the register we want to write, and also the data we want to put there. And these writes won't take effect until the rising edge of the clock signal. And at that point in time, based on both the index of the register we select and the data, the register will be updated. So questions about this operation? So one way to think about how this might be working internally is that we might have one way you could implement this register file is we could have a whole bunch of registers for each of the actual like assembly registers. And for reading, these would all go to a big mux, which would give us our register value, and the input here would be the read register number. So that might be one way we could implement this. We don't have to implement it, but that's sort of what might be going on internally. And for writing, what might happen is that there would be basically sort of, there'd be some circuit which says, you know, if the, which would check the write number, and if it matches, it would choose based on that whether to feed back the old value of the register or to take in the data to write. And we'd have that for each register, and it would check whether the write register number matches the index there. And either feed in make the register not change its value by feeding in its old value, just looping it back in, or sending in a new value from one of these data to write inputs. So that's the way it might work internally. You're not actually implementing it, but I wanted to say this is something that could be built from the registers we've seen in muxes. It would just be very tedious, especially the write part where we'd have to write, you know, 15 muxes, one for each register that selects the value to write. So we're not going to have you do that. We're just going to say this is a component that we've given you that you can use already. Now, there's one thing you might notice is a little awkward here, if you're carefully, which is that we have to always specify some data to write and a place to write it. And this seems like a problem for instructions like nop, which probably shouldn't change any registers. And we're going to have a special solution for that, which is that we're going to reserve a register index 15, which in HTLS you can use the constant regnum for. We're not going to use that for actual register 15, which, remember, doesn't exist. This is going to represent no register. So if you write to that register, it just does nothing. If you read from that register, you always get zero. There's no real register that corresponds to that index. So when we don't want to write to a register, we're going to specify the register number to write is 15, and that's going to effectively ignore any potential write. Yes? Question, can I read and write from the same register at the same time? Yes. So what's going to happen there is, remember, the writes happen at the rising edge of the clock signal. So we're going to read before that. So we'll read the old value and write a new value. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So I've shown this register file kind of abstractly, but all these components have names in HTLRS. You can also look them up in the HTLRS README linked at the top of the course web page on the heading HTLRS. So we have two register indexes to read called reg source A and source B. These names roughly match the textbook. We've added reg underscore prefixes to make it clear this is register file, not something else. We have two register indices to write, dest E and dest M. And corresponding inputs, and their register numbers to read have corresponding outputs, output A and output B. HTLS will let you omit some of these, and if you, for example, if you don't never set reg-d, it will be as if you hard-coded it to regnum. So you don't have to like always set all of these, unlike the instruction memory. There's sensible defaults in the case where you don't do that, which is why the processors we've already shown you actually work, even though they haven't dealt with the register file yet. Okay. Questions? Our register file. Okay, so now that we have a register file, we can store register values. Let's build our add processor. So for running add instructions, we're going to need to actually fetch the instruction, and we really need the instruction this time because we need to know what registers it uses. So to fetch the instruction, we're going to take our PC register, we're going to get the instruction from the instruction memory, we're going to split it into its different pieces by just subsetting the bits of the output of the instruction memory. One of the things we're going to do is we're going to set the stat signal, so you like do halt or not halt. And we're also going to get out of the instruction memory the two register indices that the add instruction is using. And the first thing we need to do is we need to read both of those registers. So we're going to connect those two register indices to the register indices to read input of our register file to get the two outputs, which are the values of those registers, the two 64-bit values. We're going to have to add those together. That's the actual work the instruction is doing, which takes up a very small part of this picture, which is going to be a theme, but all our instructions, the actual work the instruction's doing is a very small part of the picture. Most of it's just moving data around to make that happen. So once we've added the values together, we need to store it. So to do that, we're going to attach it to the input data, part of the register file and a corresponding register number to write. On this register file here, I only drew one of the write inputs instead of both, just to keep the diagram a little less cluttered. Yes?
So the capital R's are those register files or just registers?
The capital R's, those register files. Sometimes I in the book will represent the contents of registers as register index, or register 0 would be like the register with index 0. And similarly, I might represent the contents of memory as an array M, where M of 0 is memory at address 0. Does that answer your question? So yeah, so this R notation is just register with that index, M notation, M brackets is memory at that index. So if we think of running this with this little program here, let's say our PC starts to be 0, then I want to set, and let's say RAX is 10 and RBX is 20 and RDX is 30. If I run add RAX RDX, we're going to read 10 and 30 by passing 0 and 2, the indices in our table for what those registers correspond to in machine code. So we're going to get 10 and 30 out of here, which is going to add up to 40. The 40 is going to go into our register file along with a 2. So at the next rising edge of the clock, when we transition to the next program counter value, we're going to get 40 in our RDX register. So questions on the operation with our register file? So there's something I didn't draw here, which is very important. Someone tell me what that is. Something that's missing from this picture that is necessary to make this work. Yes, back there. We need to set the program counter to something. The program counter register just has nothing here. And if we want to advance the next instruction, we need to know what the next PC value is. So we need to do PC plus 2. And then, you know, we can think of simulating the next steps in this setting. So after we do PC plus 2, we know during the next cycle, when we set RDX to 40, we're also going to set the PC to 2 at the exact same time, because they're both triggered by that rising edge of the clock signal. They're both going to happen in sync. We're going to go on to the next step. It's going to have new register values and a new, including a PC and the register file registers. And in this case, our instruction is RBX and RDX. So we're going to have the index for RBX going here, and the index for RDX to source B. So we're going to add 20 and 40 to get 60. And so 60 and the index of RDX is going to be our input, and that's why we're going to end up writing 60 after the next rising edge of the clock when we also advance the PC to 4. Yes? Why are we doing program counter plus 2? So if we look back at our instruction format, we have 2 bytes. So this is our first byte, and this is our second byte. So it just needs to be, so that's why I need to advance by 2 for these instructions. Other questions? Okay. So I have this sort of written out, sort of drawn out. Let's go through the actual code to do this in HTLRS. So we have our program counter I need to declare. In this case, I've named the ends lowercase p and uppercase p, and I've called it PC, which is 64 bits and starts at 0. I've implemented my increment circuit with just plus 2, we've seen this before, and I've connected it to the instruction memory, so we'll read out into i10 bytes the actual value. Then I extract
the I code, that first 4 bits of the opcode, and RA and RB from the I10 bytes output, just implementing what I labeled as split. And I connect RA and RB to our register files, register index to read inputs, which remember are source A and source B, which means that out of output A and output B come the values. So I add those two values together, connect them to the data to write input, which is input E. And I also set the corresponding index with DESTY to also be RB. So RB will be written at the end of the cycle. And not shown here is setting stat, but we've already seen how to do that. Some questions about the code I've used here, how it corresponds to this picture. Okay, so that's add. So I guess something to note is that we have a textbook that has its own hardware description language, which is a little different. The most noticeable differences you'll see is in our textbook, they have, rather than calling things wires with arbitrary widths, they have bools and ints, and they aren't precise about the widths of signals being sent. The book uses some names which are, I would say, kind of obnoxious. Like, they call a signal VALC. What is VALC supposed to be? Can you guess from the name? No, it's a horrible variable name. But the book uses it, so I'm going to often use it on slides because you might be referring to the book. But if you want your HTML code to not use those names, go ahead. You can use whatever nice names you like you can call something constant instead of VALC. In the book, their case expressions don't need a default case, we need one. Also, the book provides some components that we're not going to provide you for the upcoming assignments. So one example of this is the book provides something called an ALU, which stands for Arithmetic Logic Unit. We're not going to provide that. We're going to have you deal with that separately. And I'll talk about ALUs next. Questions on thing differences from the book and naming? So about arithmetic logic units. So ALUs, or arithmetic logic units, are a component in a processor that does a bunch of different types of logic and computation. And the typical form these take is that they take usually two inputs along with an operation select, and they produce an operation of that, those inputs. The operations might be like addition, subtraction, multiplication, bitwise operations, and this would just be one circuit that does all those operations and hopefully is built cleverly to like try to share logic like between addition and subtraction and bitwise and so on, which you can do if you're designing these, you know, at a lower level. So our textbook, they were provided with one. We're not going to provide you with one because you can kind of build this yourself in HTLRS, maybe not the most efficient way if we're thinking about actually building the hardware, by just using the operators plus, minus, times, and so on, and amongst, to like select between do I want A plus B or A minus B. So we're not supplying you with one, but that's a component that they're talking about, and it's a real thing that exists in processors, that someone will focus on building just this part of the processor, and you know, we'll have the circuitry around it. And in this class, we're not actually going to talk in much about how you would build a good ALU. Our assumption is that that's something that people who are probably electrical engineering majors would do and provide to people building processors, you know, as a component to use. So one thing which confuses people about ALU, me talking about ALUs, is that you might look at this and say, oh, so we have two ALUs here. We have this one and this one, right? And not really. So in the design our textbook suggests and when we're going to build, we have one ALU. But we have some additional circuits that do computation and logic. And the most notable of this is the PC increment is going to be done with a separate circuit. And generally this won't be an LU, because for the PC increment, we can have a much more specialized thing that only knows how to add. It's not going to be a general purpose arithmetic thing. But we'll have an ALU for the actual arithmetic work of instructions that needs to be a little more flexible, because the instructions are going to do things other than just adding a small number. Okay, so that's on the ALU. So questions on ALUs. Okay, so we saw this not halt CPU earlier. And I also showed you an add CPU. And ultimately, we want to support not halt and add. So let's think about how we would do that. So we want to combine this CPU with our add CPU. And the general process we're going to have for like doing that is we're going to say, okay, I know what I want to do for add. I know what I want to do for not and halt. How do I put these together? Well, there's going to be some conflicts. There's going to be some things where for not we want to do one thing, for halt, and for like add we want to do a different thing. And how are we going to solve that? We're going to add a mux. We're going to have a case expression which says if it's not for halt, do this thing. If it's add, do this other thing. And so my question here is, thinking about our two designs, where are cases where we need to add a mux? Where if we're writing our HCL code, we would need a case expression to decide between two different things depending on our instruction. This is a process we want to get comfortable with, because this is how we're going to keep adding new, more and more new instructions. We're going to say, where do I need to make a decision depending on what instruction I'm dealing with? So give you a few minutes to look over this list and think about where do we need to make a decision. Because we look at our two processors, except for setting stat, which isn't one of these options, so far we haven't needed any muxes between those two processors. So where do we need to add? And I guess for clarity, by register number here, I mean the index of a register, the number that appears in the instruction to identify which register it is.
Who likes more time? Okay, so who thinks we want one for A, for the register index to read inputs? Okay, a few people. For B, for the PC registers input? Also a few people. For C, before the register index to write inputs? Okay, some more people, not the same. Before the register value to write inputs? Okay, a bunch of people. And before the address memory input to the instruction memory. Okay, so we all have agreement on that. So let's talk about these in order. So for A, the case you'd make for why you'd want to have some choice here is that you'd say, well, the NOP instruction, it shouldn't read any registers. The halt instruction doesn't read any registers. If I write down what that instruction does, nothing about reading registers is involved. So don't I need to stop us from reading registers? And that's not unreasonable, but it's not necessary. And the reason I'd say it's not necessary is because if we read RAX when we don't care about its value, it's not going to do anything bad. So I would say A would be okay, but not needed. So we could have a mux to decide to pass the special reg none value in the case of NOP. And obviously, in the case of add, we'd actually read the registers we're adding. But that's not necessary because if we read registers in the case of NOP, that's not going to cause anything to break. So long as we don't like do things based on those register values. So B, we had a few people said we want to do something for B, and I think we definitely need to do something for B. And let's look at why. So here we have add one, which is supposed to go into the program counter. And if we look back at our add CPU, we have add two. Those are not the same value, and we need to choose which one we're doing based on whether we're running an add or a NOP. So we need to have to choose between plus one for a NOP or plus two for an add, because their instructions are different lengths. So we need a mux or something very much like a mux to make that choice. Okay, then we have C and D, and I think we had broad consensus that we need to do something about one of these. And the problem we have is that if we do nothing, then the NOP instruction is going to change the registers, and it better not change the registers. And I think a lot of you wanted to solve this problem by making sure we set the input to write to something that won't change anything. This is something we could do, but I think it's the less easy way. So let's think about modifying our, this to have an option where we don't change the value. So if your proposal is that we put a mux in front of the value here, what we're saying is that we want to send something into here that won't change anything. We can absolutely do that. The value we'd use for that would in this case be source B, and we just feed back that value directly. So that would be an option. I think that's a more awkward way of doing it than if instead we took advantage of the special register value we mentioned, which doesn't change anything, and passed that as the register index to write. But we need to do one of those two things. We can choose either one. I think changing dest e is the simpler one rather than changing the register value input. So I would say that this is sort of preferred solution, which is reg dusty equals reg none. For nop. So for nop, we just set it to reg none, which is, remember, it ignores the right. And this would be sort of alternative to C, but probably more awkward. So questions on C and D? Okay, and the instruction memory address input, we don't need to do anything about because it's always should be what's in the PC register as long as we set the PC register correctly. So we don't need to have any additional circuitry to like choose a different value. Everyone comfortable with this? So we have this idea that, oh, if I want to add an instruction, I just think about all the things in my processor that I need to like wire up for the new instruction and where they conflict with my existing instruction. If I have conflicts, I add a mux, a case expression to decide what to do for one instruction versus another. This is going to be the general pattern we're going to use to build out our processor and implement all of the instructions. So let's start by going through how we do the move to register instructions. And to talk about this, we need to talk about accessing memory, because this last instruction here reads from memory. And you might say, okay, well, we can do that. We have an instruction memory. But the problem is that the instruction memory is already being used to read the instruction. And you might say, well, okay, we'll read the instruction, and then we'll read 10 plus RxX from there. And maybe we could make that work, but the problem is to make that work without having a loop that we said would be unstable, we would need to have this instruction, this MRMoveQ instruction, take two cycles. We need to like get the value of the address we want, then in the next cycle we need to read from that address, because we can't have a loop where we read an address and use that to compute another address without any synchronization. Otherwise, we'll get that same sort of phenomenon we had with our add one circuit that wasn't stable. But we're going to still run our instructions in one cycle, and our solution for that is we're going to have a second memory. So we have our instruction memory. We're also going to have a data memory. We're just going to have two of them. And that way, we don't have to worry about how can I use the instruction memory twice in the same cycle? We're not gonna. We're gonna use the instruction memory once and the data memory once. Everything's just being used once. There's no problem. And our data memory is gonna actually work a little differently than our instruction memory. And the main reason for this is that the data memory is also gonna support writing. We're not gonna do writing yet. We'll come do that a little later today. But it's going to support writing, and we're going to have signals to control whether it reads or writes, which I've labeled write-enable and read-enable. These are both going to have names in HCLRS that you can look up in the documentation. So when we're reading, these both work that we put in an address, and in the case of the data memory, we enable reading. In the case of the instruction memory, reading is always enabled, and we get in the same cycle, before the next rising 8 o'clock, we get the value at that address. In the case of the data memory, this value is a 64-bit output. In the case of the instruction memory, it's an 80-bit output, just because they're used for different things. For reading values into registers, we want 64 bits, not 80 bits. Now, the data memory also supports writing. So when it's in writing mode, when the write-enable signal is set, at the rising edge of the clock, it's going to write the input here to the address, modified memory at that time, the same time we would modify registers and so on.
So it works very similarly to the register file as far as what the timing is, or register for those writes. And these signals all have names in HTLRS, so we saw that the instruction memory, you have PC as the input, I10 bytes as the output. For the data memory, all the inputs and outputs are prefixed with mem, and we have mem input for the value to write, mem adder for the address to read from or write to. Mem write bit and mem read bit are the enable disable signals for read and write, and mem output is the output. I guess I should mention, if you don't have writing enabled, then the mem input signal just isn't going to do anything. If you don't have reading enabled, then the mem output signal just isn't going to have anything useful. It's going to be zero just so it has value, but it's not something you should be using. So questions about the operation of our data memory? Okay, so we have this second memory. And one question you might have is, so does that mean our data is stored separately from our instructions? That there are different things that are, you know, completely, you know, separate addresses. That an address that we jump to is not the same as an address we read from. No, they're all the same addresses. These two memories actually are going to access the same thing. That, in fact, in the simulator, if you write to an address in the data memory, it's going to change what the instruction memory reads later. So you can think of it that it's really just one memory, and maybe it's one memory with multiple ways of accessing it. We'll talk about why we're calling them separate memories and like how this would work more physically when we talk about caches. So there's a reason why this design treats them as kind of separate components, because physically they're going to be, even though they're backed by the same storage. We'll talk about exactly what that design will look like much later in the semester when we talk about caches. But the preview is that the data memory and the instruction memory represent what's really a data cache and an instruction cache. Okay, so let's, with that interlude out of the way, talk about implementing our move instructions. So we have these move instructions. Question is, where do we want to have boxes for these? So these are cases where are we going to have to do different things depending on which of these three instructions we're running. So I'm asking you for the register number, register index inputs. So source A, source B, dest D, dest M. Before the value inputs, input E, input M. Before the PC registers input. And for the instruction memory address inputs. I'll give you a minute to go over that. And then we're going to go to using that answer to actually make a diagram of what this would look like. Who'd like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay, so who thinks A, before the register index inputs, we want some sort of box? Couple people. Who thinks for B we'd want a box before the value inputs? Seems to be a majority. Okay. For the PC registers input, who thinks we'd want something? A few people. And before the instruction memory address input? No people. Okay. So we'll start with the simpler ones. So the instruction memory address input, we don't need it. It's just going to be fed from the program counter. And we're going to fix things by making the program counter change. And we do need a mux before the program counter. And this is because of information that's not really on this slide. That, if you remember our encoding, this instruction is 10 bytes in machine code, as is the MRMOVEQ. So MRMOVEQ and MRMOVEQ are both 10 bytes in machine code. And RMOVEQ is 2 bytes. So we need to do plus 2 or plus 10. So we need to make that choice. We're going to need something like a mux to do that. Maybe we could find some way of doing it with some other logic, but it's going to be equivalent to having a mux there. Yes? Where's the 2 bytes for? RMOVEQ is 2 bytes in machine code. So the value input, pretty much everyone agreed because, well, the value to write, value input, is what value do you want to put in the register? And in the RMOVEQ, we want to put the constant in one of the registers. The RMOVEQ, we want to put a value we just read from a register in one of the registers. The MRMOVEQ, we want to put a value we just read from memory in one of the registers. So those are going to come from 3 different places. So we need a mux to choose between them. So we definitely want a mux for the value, because we can't just get the value from one place. Like, it's not just going to be the result of an addition. It's going to come from a whole bunch of different places. So then we have A, which is probably the trickiest one here. So a first thing you might say is, oh, well, you know, this RMOVEQ doesn't read any registers and the others do. So maybe we have to control the registers we read that way. But if you remember what I said about NOP, that you can absolutely do that. It's not unreasonable, but it's probably not really necessary because reading registers doesn't do anything bad. So it seems like we don't actually need one for the sources because we can read registers and not use their values. And yes, for RMOVEQ, we're reading some register we don't care about or trying to, and maybe that's not so great. So maybe for a source, it doesn't seem a problem. Then we have a destination, and you might say, oh, these all write to RYY, so that shouldn't be a problem. But there's a catch that's really subtle. And that's, if we look at the encoding here, MRMOVEQ writes to RA, which is in from this part, from the most significant 4 bits of the second byte, and the others write to RB, which is from the least significant part. So we actually need to supply different indices to write for MRMOVEQ versus the others. Which is really subtle, but it's the way things are designed. And you might say, why did our textbook authors design the instruction set this way? It's to make this part, the DRB, be the same between both of the memory move instructions. That they wanted that to always use RB to make other parts of the circuit simpler. So it turns out here for Desti being RA for MRMOVEQ versus RB everything else. And for, I guess, all right, for the dust. Yeah, just. So we're going to need a mux because the destination register is either RA or RB, depending on exactly which instruction we're using. So we definitely need some sort of mux, at least, to handle that situation. Okay, so questions? Yeah?
Can you give us, like, an explanation again on why, like,
So the question is, what was the general reason we're using a multiplexer? So the multiplexer is how we make a choice in our processor. And the main choices we want to make is if we're running one type of instruction, we want to do things differently than another. So where we're doing an IR move queue, we want to do things differently than an R move queue. Now, I think I'll have a concrete example when we go through this slide. We're going to look at these instructions. So the way I'm going to build up to our multiplexers, I'm going to say, let's start by implementing R move queue. So for R move queue, we're going to read the instruction. I'm going to just read from RA. I'll just read from RB because we don't care about it. So I'll get the value of RA from a register file and connect it to the destination along with setting that destination. So this is implementing R move queue, and now I want to add I remove queue to this. And if I want to add I remove queue to this, what I want to do for that process is I want to connect the immediate to this input queue. But I can't do that because I already have something else connected there. So what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to add a mux to choose between those two values. So I'm going to have a mux here where, based on the opcode, based on whether I see a 2 or a 3 at the beginning of the instruction here, I'm going to either send the value I read from register A or the immediate, the constant from the instruction to the register file. And every time I find a place in my circuit where I need to make that sort of decision, where what I want to do for one instruction differs from what I want to do for another, I'm going to add this mux that's usually going to be controlled based on the opcode. So then I can repeat that process for our MR move queue here. So for this MR move queue, I'm going to take the same immediate, which I now call D. I'm going to add it to the result of RB, which we're reading out of here, and then access the memory. So that looks like this. So I take the result of RB, access the memory, get the value out of the memory, and that's going to be another choice on this mux here for what do I write. And also, because we have RA versus RB as a destination, I'm going to choose which register index I tell the register file to write to, depending based on which instruction I have. Some questions about this diagram? Yes. Can I have wires cross? Yes, and I do. That's what this represents here. And we're writing things in text, so we don't have to worry about wires crossing. In a physical processor, things are three-dimensional, so there are ways of dealing with wires crossing. So it shouldn't actually be a problem. Okay. Other questions? Okay, and so we can look at each of these parts of the circuit and we can think of how they're represented in CLRS. So for example, we mentioned how the data memory works. So here we're setting the MEP address input, and also I didn't show it explicitly, but we're enabling reading on the data memory or else it won't know to read by setting the read bit signal to 1. And also there's one other thing we need, which as we mentioned, we need to control the PC increment here. So we have, in this case, I just do +2 and +10, and I choose between them again based on the opcode. So for R move Q, I'm going to add 2. For everything else, I'm going to add 10. Some questions? My diagram here. Okay. So this is all the instructions that move a value to a register. There's one move instruction I've omitted, which is the one that moves a value to memory. So for implementing that, what do I need to change here? Someone tell me something that I need to do to implement my move array to memory at D plus RB. Bunch of things we're missing to implement this instruction. So what's the main thing this instruction does? If I like showed you assembly with this instruction and you wanted to describe it to me, can someone describe what this instruction does? RM move Q instruction. Yes?
Takes the value in register A and writes it to memory at R, B, plus B.
Okay, so it takes a value in register A and writes it to memory at R, B, plus D. So let's go through that description. It takes a value in register A. So my first question is, can I get the value from register A? The only way I can do that is if I'm asking the register file for register A on one of these inputs, and it turns out that this source A, because of the other instructions, we know is going to be register A. It's going to be those bits of the instruction. So we have that, and the value of register A is right here. So we have the value of register A. So we got that first part. So it takes the value of register A and writes it to memory. So to write to memory, we need to supply to the data memory the place to write. So we're supplying a place to write. We'll need to check if it's the right one. And the value to write. We're not supplying any value to write. So we need to fix that by wiring up that value to write to the value we want to write. We also need to have some way of enabling write. So we're going to have remember, there's a write enable signal. So from something, we're going to have the write enable input, which to indicate that the memory should be in write mode instead of read mode sometimes. Only for the last instruction, because for other instructions, we want to read. Okay. And we wanted to write to memory at D plus RB. So where is D here? Well, this immediate here, this is V or D, depending on which instruction we have. They're from the same place, so it's always the same. So you want to take D plus the value of RB, and it turns out we already compute that because it's the same memory location that we're using for MRMOQ. So the address input is actually correct, and this is why the textbook authors decided to order RA and RB the same for both of these, the way they did for those instructions, so we didn't have to add a mux before the plus there to change which values we added. Okay. So is there anything I missed? We're all set? Yeah? Question, will it take two clock cycles? So to think about that, we should think about when do values actually change? And the way our data memory works is it writes at the rising edge of the clock. So once we set up these inputs, and all the components up to here don't rely on the clock at all, right? When we send a register index here, in the same clock cycle we get its value, same thing with this adder, when we send two values to add, same clock cycle we get a value. So at the next rising edge of the clock, after we start this instruction, after we start it, get to put the PC here, we're going to set up the rising edge will happen, and the write will finish. So it will take one clock cycle, and that write will happen at the same time as we advance to the next instruction by choosing a new PC, because it's the same clock signal. It's going to go to the next PC and also update the memory. So it will take one cycle. Other questions or any comments on, is there something I missed here? Yeah. Do I need a mux to decide whether I'm reading or writing from the memory? Yes, so I'm gonna need some sort of, so there's a, remember we had this read enable and write enable signal? If I go back, yeah, so I'm gonna need these signals, which I didn't really draw. I'm going to need some sort of mux or something like that to control them. That is absolutely a thing I'm going to need. So I'm going to have, this is going to be controlled by some sort of mux to decide whether we're reading or writing. That's what I'm going to need. Anything else? Yeah. Why don't we allow it to read or write always? Allowing it to read always might not be such a big deal. Allowing it to write always means that when we're running instructions, like let's say we're running a NOP instruction, that means the NOP instruction, there's going to be a value here. It's going to be some sort of value, and we're going to modify memory when we don't want to. Does that answer your question? Because remember, like even if we're not don't care about the value, it's still going to have a number there. That number might do things if we aren't careful. Okay. Other questions? Or comments about things I might have missed? Okay, so there's one important thing I didn't put on here, which is necessary to make this R move Q instruction work correctly. And think about that. Let's think about we have RA and RB. And if we think about the register index to write signal, it's we're either writing to RA or RB. But for RM move Q, we want to write to neither. And that is not an option in the mux I have drawn on this dest E input. We have to either choose RA or RB. We can't choose neither. So we're going to need to add a neither option to that mux. And what's our neither option going to be? It's that register none value, which just happens to be 15. So that means this, that we're going to have an option, we need to add to that mux an option to pass register number 15 for don't write anything, and also to have the drawn out version, and also that's the write enables. Questions about how build our move diagram of how we do just all the moves. Okay, so one thing you might notice is getting a little cluttered here is that I have a whole bunch of things that depend on my opcode and things like that, including one here where I didn't even draw, like if I drew this properly, like we'd have to have this going all the way from over here. And if I keep doing that and go through all my instructions, it's gonna get very messy. So going forward, I'm not gonna draw all of that stuff. I'm gonna only draw what we'll call the data path. So the data path are the signals carrying the sort of actual data the processor is operating on versus the control path, which is like the signals that control what muxes do. I'm not going to draw the control path. I'm just going to say, there's a mux here, but I'm not drawing the circuitry that decides which option it chooses. And this is just for space. So in this diagram here, what I've highlighted in red here, this is all control path stuff that I'm not going to draw going forward just for clutter reasons. So, and I also should show completeness, there's a not completely drawn signal. But just because if I go through all our instructions, that's going to get very messy to include all that control path. And when you typically see, like in the real world diagrams of processors, they also usually will not draw this control path stuff. They will just draw the data path and assume that you can figure out the control path, and it's not really what you want to know how the processor is working. So questions on data path versus control path? Oh, and I guess I should mention, as mentioned on the slide, that this is not like a firm definitional line, so we're not going to like test you on it. For example, condition codes, are they data path or control path? Kind of in between. We're not going to care about the details of that, but people would disagree on whether that's data or control path. Okay. Some questions? Okay, so we have this processor here. And if you read our textbook divides this processor into what they call stages. And I've highlighted the stages that they have on this diagram. So they have a fetch stage. The fetch stage is where we compute the PC increment and also fetch the instruction. They have a decode stage. And you would think the decode stage is where we split up the instructions into its pieces. It's not. It's where we read the registers. Yes, it's not a great name. It is a real name that appears also in the literature sometimes. Also, sometimes it appears as the more logical definition, but by decode, our book means reading the right registers. Then we have execute, which is where we do computation, where we do the ALU operation, which for these move instructions is the address computation if we have one. Then we have a memory stage, where we access memory, reading or writing, and we have a write-back stage where we actually modify registers. So these stages are a conceptual division of the instruction. So right now, they're just a way of dividing up the parts of the instruction so that we can think about separate parts separately, but they don't actually determine the order in which the instruction happens. What determines the order in which things in the instruction happens? The wiring of this diagram. So, for example, you know, the fetch stage is directly connected to the write-back stage in this diagram, so the write-back stage will start doing things right away, right, based on that. And also, there's a clock signal, which we haven't shown, and that's going to control when lots of things happen. So we have this conceptual division. Later on, we're going to have a different processor design which takes advantage of these stages and turns them into something not so conceptual. But for now, it's a conceptual division, and the reason it's helpful is because it's going to let you think about smaller parts of the processor when we're designing the processor and figuring out like what muxes to add and what they do. Okay. And we've talked a bunch about what the actual timing of our processor components is, which remember is based on the clock signal and doing things as their inputs change. So with that in mind, I have talking about the push RAX instruction. So the push RAX instruction reads an instruction. Based on that instruction, realizes the push, and it's going to change memory, the stack pointer, and the program counter. My question is, when are those things going to happen? Based on how our processor components works. We talked about how our data memory works today. We talked about how our register file works today. We talked about how the instruction memory works last time and the PC register works last time. So based on all that, what order do these things happen in the sort of processor designs we're talking about? So if I add that instruction to our move processor we had it saw earlier. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, a few people, C, D, okay, E, and F? Okay, so I think D and C, E were our biggest answers. So let's talk about how these components work. And our instruction memory, this read happens right, after we have an input, we have a new input. So that's going to be probably earliest, and happens first in all those. Memory changes. When does this happen? At a rising edge of the clock. Edge of the clock after inputs are set up. So just like our register file, during the cycle, before that rising edge, we're going to set up the inputs to the data memory, and then it's going to happen. Then the change is going to happen. How about the RSP? So this is part of the register file. The way the register file works is we set up the inputs during the cycle, and at the rising edge of the clock, after the inputs have been set up during the cycle, that's when the actual write's going to happen. Same time, same triggering event as changing the memory values with the data memory. They both happen based on that rising edge of the clock. They're set up earlier, but the actual change to memory in the registers is based on that clock signal. And the same is also true of the PC. We compute the address of the next instruction probably very early, but that's not going to actually be used until that rising edge of the clock says to use it. So the answer we actually want is B. And the reason I go over this is because the stages in the textbook make you really want to say these things happen in a specific order. But right now, they don't. Because of how our hardware works, the clock signal does all the changes to actual values that are stored. Everything else happens as the sort of values flow through the circuit. Later on, we're going to have a different design where these stages will be in actual order. But we're going to do that by adding extra storage components like new registers. That's why it's going to work that way. Okay, so that's all I have for today. So a logistical note, probably next time we'll be in Gilbert Hall, and there will be an email about that.